I would like to call this the meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. I want to say, first of all, before we start, a big thank you to Clay County for helping put this together today. I do understand that this will be streaming on the House website, so some of our colleagues who were not able to make it up here today are going to be listening to everything we have online here. So I want to make folks realize, well, I mean, I have the whole committee here. Most of them are at least listening in. So I want to thank them for all doing that, and thank you, my colleagues, for being here. As we get started, I do want to first let folks know that the Human Services Policy Committee, kind of give you an idea of our purview. We focus on a lot of different things in the human services area, primary long-term funding, whether it's assisted living, nursing homes, disability services, human services in terms of what's happening in the homeless area, and then quite a bit in the mental health, behavioral health, and SUD area. And that's part of the reason that we're up here today is focusing is what's working, what isn't, and hearing from folks in the local community what's happening in the child mental health system. And so I want to say thank you for the opportunity to be up here, and I'd like to turn it over to Representative Keeler for a couple of quick comments, and then I'll have the other folks up here introduce themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really just thank you to the committee for coming out here. One of the things I have said over and over is, as I represent a Border City, Greater Minnesota community, when I go to Minneapolis, St. Paul during session, our community just really gets missed in a lot of the conversations, and I know it's extremely hard for us to drive to the cities to testify in the middle of the hardest weathers that we have. I know that a lot of us are strapped. Workforce is always difficult. You know, one of the things I look at is Nicole and just trying to hold down our childcare systems here. You know, to have people take a whole entire day to drive down to the cities is really difficult. And so I appreciate the chair and the committee coming here to listen to our community, our needs, and things that we really struggle with, or the things that we thrive in differently out here. So thank you all for showing up and being a part of this with us.
Okay, thank you. And then Representative Curran, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is Representative Breon Curran. I'm from District 36B, which is Vadnais Heights, White Bear Lake, or one of the northern suburbs of St. Paul.
And then we have a guest with us. We even allow the Senate to attend here.
I know I feel very honored to be in a House hearing here. So I'm Senator Rob Kupek. I'm very happy anytime fellow legislators, whether they be from the House or the Senate, come to Clay County to be here to greet them. So thank you very much for coming up for this hearing.
You're welcome. Representative Keeler.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Keeler. Keel and Keeler go together very easily. Thank you all for being here. It's wonderful to be here. I'm representative of District 1B, so just north of us all. I serve Polk, Red Lake, and Norman County, and just a little bit of Clay. There's three townships in Clay, the precincts that I serve. So, and I farm up in the Polk area. So,
Representative Novotny.
I'm Representative Paul Novotny, represent 30B, which is Elk River, Otsego, Oak Grove, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, very good. And then my RCA.
I'm Nick Stumelanger. I'm the Community Administrator for the Human Services Policy Committee, and thank you so much for welcoming up here to Clay County.
And the Committee Legislative Assistant. Yes, Spencer.
Spencer Kroos, happy to be here.
Oh, yes. And also we have staff in the back. We have, I can see them waving. It's Jonathan Cotter and Jacob.
Grunhaus.
Thank you. Jacob Grunhaus. And then you've got your intern here. Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. I forgot. Angie. All right. And did I forget any other staff? I don't think so. I think we've got them all. All right, very good. Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is the part where we're going to be taking testimony regarding the children's mental health services that are available in the area. What are the needs? What's working? What isn't? And so we have a number of people who've signed up for testimony. And before I start calling people, I do want to let folks know that on the House website that we have, on today's calendar, when you go to that, you'll find that we have some written testimony that is also posted online. So I want to let folks know that if anyone is here that does not want to testify but want to provide written testimony, they can submit that to our committee administrator, Nick Strumel-Langer, and then he will also get that posted online. So any other information that comes in will also be posted online also and then sent out to committee members. And with that, we will get underway. The first person that I have that I'll be calling up will be Michelle Thordel, Children's Mental Health and Children Protective Services Supervisor from Clay County Social Services. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee, for your interest in the issue of high acuity and complex mental health needs and your willingness to travel to Clay County for the hearing. For the record, my name is Michelle Thordel, Supervisor at Clay County Social Services. I supervise Children's Mental Health Services and Child Protection Services and have worked in this area for over 20 years. Today I'm here with two families, Gina Life and Kim Larson, who would like to share their journey of navigating the mental health service system to access the care and services their children need. The difficulties our two families have experienced highlight some of the gaps in Minnesota's continuum of care for services needed to support children with significant, high acuity, complex, and/or co-occurring conditions, oftentimes involving the confluence of mental health, development, and substance use needs. While these needs have been present while I've worked in this area, the pandemic and challenges of recent years have highlighted the shaky foundation and gaps in addressing the mental health needs of Minnesotans, specifically youth, children, and their families. Without addressing these challenges, we will continue to see youth and families struggle. What is the answer to addressing these needs? The answers are as complicated as the issues that present, and to demand that County Human Services, along with our state and community partners, inform the development of a sustainable array of services to help meet the mental health needs of children and their families. Minnesota has few options available to address the high acuity needs. Our gaps include limited in-state residential placements, limited mental health services and programming, a workforce that struggles to meet the challenges and demand, and limited options for in-home services and supports, including respite care and specialized foster care placements. We recommend that Minnesota resource evidence-informed therapeutic services and supports by developing an array of services such as community resource centers, community-based mental health programming like SIBS, respite care, specialized foster care, intensive residential treatment, and psychiatric residential treatment facilities. Adequate funding and service reimbursements are critical to assuring services are available across the state for families to access when needed. We know that we are not alone. Many of the barriers our families have experienced are prevalent across other counties in Minnesota and throughout the nation. While we continue to elevate the unique role that counties play in Minnesota in providing services, we couldn't do so without our community partners, providers, and families that we serve. The stories you will hear today are very real and very personal. We are so thankful that Gina and Kim are willing to share their stories and advocate on behalf of their children. I'm proud our agency has helped these families, trying to assist them in navigating the woefully inadequate web of supports. Their stories will illustrate that as a result of mental health challenges, they have also faced difficulties with the educational system and juvenile justice system, again illustrating the complexity of this work. At this time, I'll close my remarks and turn it over to Gina Life and Kim Larson. Following their remarks, we'll be available for questions.
Thank you very much. Gina Life, if you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please. And welcome to the committee.
Okay. Thank you for having me. I'm Gina Life, and I am here for my daughter, Emma. She's 16 now, and we adopted her as a baby, and she was addicted to meth. Her biological parents, which is my half-sister, so I know this to be true, they're both schizophrenic. So to say she came into the world with a few things against her is an understatement. In her toddler years, we knew she was just different. I have two older children, and at school, when it would come time to do what the teacher says or, you know, play ball, it was always just how she wanted it to go. She wouldn't... just wouldn't listen. She was just very, very, very headstrong. And we knew then that there were problems. So her dad and I divorced. And when she was in fourth grade, she moved to Montana to be with him during the school year and me with the summer and during holidays. She started having trouble in school then. She started doing drugs, running with the wrong crowd. And there you can drive at 15, so she had her license. And one day she was mad. Her dad told her no, she couldn't go somewhere after school. And she went flying through the parking lot and almost ran over the resource guy working in the parking lot. She called me here, there in Montana, and within 30 minutes, she called and she was in the back of the cop car. They, you know, had called and they arrested her. So then through high school, her freshman year, it just kept getting worse and worse. Running, she would run away from home. She was cutting herself bad. She tried to take a bottle of ibuprofen. They had to go pump her stomach. It was just constantly something all the time. And so we got her in Montana. We couldn't find any place for her to go in Montana. So we looked, we were looking everywhere, and we found Sandstone in Colorado. So we sent her there, and she was there 4 days, and she started saying she was going to kill people and cutting herself. And they sent her, her dad's in Montana, I'm here, and they sent her to the ER the day before Thanksgiving and said that she couldn't come back there, although that was a mental health place. So her dad went and got her, and then Thanksgiving we brought her here to hopefully let her have a fresh start. And it just, it was the same thing. She didn't have the school friends. We tried to get her in the YES program that Morehead has, and we were next online on the list, and it closed. After 25 years, it closed. So then we went to try to register her for school, and she just shelled up. I mean, it wasn't going to happen. She's been to 7 different counselors. She finally found one here, Jordan Cole, that she really, really likes. But another big thing is her cousin, Mason Hamry, they grew up together. He struggles with the same things, and he hung himself. And sorry. Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. Take a moment.
So we knew then how important it was to get her the help. So, all right, sorry.
Nothing.
So then when she was at the house, you know, I'm a single parent. I have to work, so I couldn't be there all the time. I'm a nurse, but I started my own cleaning business so I could be my own boss and set the times and be able to be with her, you know, when her sister couldn't or whatever. And the self-harming kept going. The drugs, I didn't know about it then, but now know that she was doing drugs. She somehow got online between her phone and her virtual reality thing. She was getting into sexual things, and I didn't even know that was a world. We went to Arizona to see her brother, and she assaulted him there. She just got mad. He was being a pesky 25-year-old brother, and she got mad. He was trying to get her to watch a movie, and she pushed him. I was holding a newborn baby, and that's when the physical started. And then we came back here, and with that happening, we went straight to her counselor, to Jordan, and she told him that she had thoughts of suicide and of harming me. And so he told me to take her to Prairie, took her to Prairie. They admitted her. She was there 2.5 weeks, and they said that she could not stay there because insurance and that she wasn't suicidal. But she said she's suicidal, and the lady told me on the phone, she said it's because of money. It's an insurance thing. So 23 minutes after that, I brought her, we were home, and she wanted to go hang out with a friend from Prairie that she met there. I told her no. I went to take her phone because that's how she was texting the person, and she got mad and punched me in the face, and I spent the night in the ER because we thought my jaw was broken, so she's very strong. But so then I pressed charges, which was very difficult to do, and she went to juvenile and was there in the top, in the upstairs, in the whatever, the secure, thank you. And then we were on the waiting list to get into the 30-day eval. We got her in that. And then she needed treatment, but there was no places open that, you know, had a spot. And so she finally got in Heartland, but she self-harmed and threatened, isn't it called Heartland? Yes. Yeah. Threatened people, and so she couldn't go there. So then she was in juvenile, had to stay in the non-secure for 2 months while we're waiting on getting her. So there's my child with mental illness fighting with the staff. You know, they put her, she had to sleep in panties and bras because she wasn't safe with clothes, and she had the smock, but she refused to wear it. She has been molested, and so as her, to make her wear her panties and bras was horrible. She took the Velcro from the smock and rubbed. I mean, she hurt herself with that, with Velcro. So we finally got her in Girard, and she's been there 2.5 months, and I don't know how long she will be there, but I'm so glad I can talk about this because there was just no help for her. You know, she needed mental health help, and there was just nothing for her. And, you know, it was all full, or it was cost too much, or and so she had to stay in juvenile because she wasn't safe at home. I wasn't safe. She wasn't safe. So I'm thankful for the help that we did get or do get, but I just pray if anything positive can come out of what we go through daily, if our story can help make a change, I will say it over and over and over because it's a horrible thing to live, and I can't imagine how those kids feel. So if we can somehow find some more help, it would be great. And thank you for letting me tell my story.
You're welcome, and thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Next, I have Ms. Kimberly Larson.
Yes. Hi, I'm Button. Yep. Usually loud enough. I'm Kim Larson. I am the parent of a 15-year-old homemade son and my jokingly 14-year-old store-bought kid, Miley. Miley is currently just right over there in non-secured detention. I adopted Miley when she was 3 years old, and I took her into my home knowing that from the age of 2 to 3, she was kicked out of 5 county foster homes because of the severity of her behaviors. Miley has reactive attachment disorder, which most of you are maybe not familiar with. Most people aren't. But it is a very serious, very rare condition that happens from significant trauma from the ages of pre-birth to 2 years old. But I got her, I took her, I love her, that's my baby. And I knew when I was adopting her that I had to move from my home in West Fargo to Minnesota. Because North Dakota, they have nothing like Minnesota. But moving to Minnesota had taught me that Minnesota has a lot of boilerplate kind of services, but none that really fit my daughter. And it wasn't long after we moved to Minnesota that Miley was up in her room and she was screaming and banging her head and crying. She was 6 years old. And I went up and I said, "Honey, what's wrong?" And she said, "My brain is telling me to kill you, but my heart doesn't want to because you're the only mom that loves me." I'm also a social worker, so I did the mom thing. You're so brave. That was very brave. Does your brain have a plan? It did. So kind of going off of what Gina said, what do? You bring him to the ER. Brought her to the ER, and the doctor came in the room, and he said, "Hey, Mom, can I talk to you a second?" "Sure." "You know, it's Sunday night. I've got 3 boys. They say they want to kill me, too." I said, "Just give me my daughter. We're going home." And she was denied placement in every facility in the tri-state area at 6 years old. Flash forward to just recently, Miley always is good for at least 5 days a week of screaming, stomping, yelling, pounding, kicking. If she's not doing that, it's like stealing, killing small animals, throwing baby goats in a water trough. You literally have to supervise her 24/7 because her brain cannot control itself in an unfettered environment. And that has kind of escalated. Like, I can deal with the screaming, kicking, stomping, whatever. I'm used to it. But recently, we were in that same predicament again that we were in when Miley was 6. She came outside and talked to me, and she said right in my face, like, calmly, she trusts me, I know that, but she said, "Mom, I'm worried that my fantasies of violence are going to turn into action plans. I don't know when, but I know it's coming. And I know that I'm going to murder you. Luckily, this was quite severe enough that the county was able to assess for safety. But then, where did they put her? She's right over there, non-secure detention. I get confused. In one of these directions. She's in non-secure, just like Gina's kid. She just had to go to the ER the other day because she was homicidal. And that was a whole joke, too. She got denied from 14 places in the tri-state area for services or treatment. And then what did they do the next day? Kicked her back to shelter care. That is a huge gap in our services for children's mental health and supports for parents that are dealing with it. I've lived with a daughter I jokingly call my murder baby for 11 years. I love her. She's amazing. She is smart and talented and brilliant and funny, just super funny. But the other stuff is not her fault. It was given to her by her previous situation. And we're on this journey together, and unfortunately, it tends to be more alone than with anybody else. We need access to specialized care for every kid in Minnesota. This is the greatest state in the country. I would never live in any other state. And we need to do better to meet the needs of severely mentally ill children. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to come forward and share your experiences with us. And what we'll do is we're going to hold on any questions until we get to the very end. So I want to thank you folks for coming up, and I will call up next. We have Amy Amundson, Ms. Amy Amundson with Child Protection Services Supervisor, Clay County Social Services. All right. And then to let folks know, is that after testifying is to make sure to sign in. Our committee legislative assistant, Spencer Crowe, will have you fill out your information so that we can have that for the record. So thank you, Ms. Amundson, for being here. When you're ready, you may go ahead and start.
Okay, thank you, Chair Fisher, for inviting me. For the record, my name is Amy Amundson. I'm a supervisor at Clay County Social Services. I supervise the ongoing Child Protection Division, which oversees a majority.
Which oversees a majority of our out-of-home placements of children in foster care and treatment facilities. Today, I'm here to inform you of some of the current challenges that the Minnesota Interstate Compact on the placement of children. Minnesota Statute 260.851, also referred to as ICPC, has on our ability to place children timely with relatives in another state. Our county seat, as many of you might know, is a border city with Fargo, North Dakota, which has a population of over 125,000. The mighty Red River divides our two cities, which for many families is just a quick trip over the bridge. Due to the divide, our agency must follow the federal statute of placing children through the ICPC process. This process requires our agency to complete an extensive amount of paperwork and submit it to our state office in St. Paul, who sends it to the referral, the ICPC office in Bismarck, North Dakota, and then on to the identified county in North Dakota. This process can take an extensive amount of time and is often delayed to it not being a priority for the receiving agency, and expedited orders are often not followed. This delays our agency's ability to immediately place children with a non-custodial parent, relatives, or kins. Oftentimes, people only think of relatives as blood-related or related through marriage, and kin can also include people that have a significant relationship to those children, such as a pastor, daycare provider, or a friend of the family. In Minnesota, our agency has the ability to identify relatives immediately and work with the family on an emergency foster care license, where the child is placed into the identified relative or kin's home while they pursue a foster care license. Preliminary checks are completed with the family, including background checks and social services checks. A home safety check is also completed with the relative to ensure the safety of the child in the home. However, in the process of an interstate placement, this process is not available to us due to ICPC regulations, which can delay placement of a child with a non-custodial parent, relative, or kin for up to months, when our agency only has 12 months to reach permanency or to reunify with a family or to reach permanency. Our agency recently had a placement of a newborn who was born in the Duluth area during a blizzard. The child had to be placed in St. Louis County's emergency foster care home until the roads were safe to travel. The newborn was then placed into a county foster home for approximately 6 weeks until a relative in Clay County could be identified. However, from the initial placement of the child, a paternal aunt and uncle in Fargo had come forward to be a placement option and permanency option for the child should they not be able to be reunified. But our agency could not place with them initially due to the ICPC process. An ICPC was submitted, and after 4 months, the child was placed with the relative. ICPC is a federal and state law that oversees the placement of children in all 50 states. The ICPC issue is a barrier not only for our county, but many other counties in Minnesota that border another state. Clay County and our state association, MCASA, welcome the opportunity to collaboratively identify solutions and develop an improved process to expedite the placement of children over state lines. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for coming forward with your information. Next on the list I have is Shauna Rettmeyer. Ms. Shauna Rettmeyer, CEO of ALMA. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please. Thank you for coming here today.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee, for this opportunity to share experiences of delivering mental health services to children and families here in Northwest Minnesota. My name is Shauna Rettmeyer, and I have the honor to serve as the CEO for ALUMA, and I am also a direct service provider as well. ALUMA is a certified community behavioral health clinic that serves all the way up to the Canadian border, along the North Dakota border, and butts right up to Clay County. We are about 7,100 square miles with a total population of 68,000 people. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to be here to drive only an hour and a half as opposed to the 5 hours that it usually takes when I come down to St. Paul. As a CCBHC, we provide a full continuum of services, but for the purposes of today, I'll focus in on our youth and family services. We provide early childhood, which is birth to five, outpatient mental health and substance use therapy, medication management, CTSS, mobile crisis, and school-linked mental health services in upwards of 23 school districts. At the end of September, we served 1,256 children and their families. And some of the situations that the Moorhead area sees is very similar to what we see as well. And through the diligence of advocacy, we, the collective provider network, committed to delivering high quality and excellent care, have really maximized the services and supports available to meet the needs of children and families. We have a foundation of excellence in braiding together a variety of funding. We look at Medicaid, we look at commercial, we have contracts and partnerships with our county human service partners. We apply for every grant under the sun to have that continuum of services. But that excellence is challenged every day with workforce issues, increased wait lists for needed care that is putting pressure on our crisis response services that could be avoided in many cases. While ALUMA does not serve in the Moorhead area, we are providing very similar services like Village Family Services that we got to meet earlier today. And I'd like to highlight one of those services, and that's CTSS. CTSS is Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, or Supports and Services. I get those two mixed up frequently. But they are foundational in supporting family preservation. This service is able to provide in-home and school-based therapy and skill building to support both the parents and the child, because often it's children in the context of that caregiver environment that they're in. And it's bolstered through trauma-informed care, helping address early onset of psychosis, depression, anxiety, and often it's adjustment due to loss, such as a divorce or death. The goal is to keep our children with their families, help them achieve their educational outcomes, and prevent higher levels of care or to divert children from correctional institutions. And I have an example that I'd like to share with you of a 9-year-old boy that was struggling with increased behaviors, that was withdrawing from friends and family. His grades were suffering. The county and the school were on a trajectory of looking at an out-of-home placement. That would mean this 9-year-old boy would have to leave his family, leave his community, leave his home, leave his school, leave his friends, everything and everyone that he knows. So imagine that. A 9-year-old boy, that's the age of my niece, so all I can think of is my niece Amari, having to leave everything that they know, and my apologies, I'm getting choked up as I'm saying that and envisioning that, because I can't imagine as I hear these parents talking about their children and having to do that. When Aluma was approached with this young boy, we asked the county to pause. Can we just try? Can we get in with CTSS? Can we try to do this? Let's try and help this family. And we were able to do that by bringing in psychotherapy to help both the children and the parents. Skills were continued to be provided in the school by the social worker in the school. We were able to get them connected with medication management. He was able to participate in our North Star Summer Program with intensive group-based skill building over the summer to help build that up. And now he's in school. He was able to stay home, and he did not have to go to out-of-home placement. A full continuum of care is really needed. However, we do know that higher levels of care are needed from time to time. Between the workforce challenges, one of the other largest barriers is the stagnation of reimbursement, preventing sustainability for many of these higher level of care services to get off the ground or to remain open. In order to have high quality programming, we need to have the financial resources to develop the systems, the processes, and the programming to provide safety, for oversight, evaluation of outcomes, training and development of our staff, because we need seasoned, well-trained providers, and we need the compensation to attract and retain those staff. In my time with Aluma, I've seen many children's residential programs close. I've seen a decline in the number of students going into this field, and I have seen an increase in the cost to deliver these services. Providers are unable to take the kind of risks of starting these intensive programs because the reimbursements have not kept up with the ability to sustain. The risk as a nonprofit is not about the business. It's about the risk to the children and to the families that depend on us to be able to be there. And if we can't financially make that, we're at risk of closure, and it becomes then a risk within the community. So my hope is that through this hearing, you were able to hear of the wonderful work that's already occurring, the desire to bolster services to ensure our communities, our children, and our families have the needed resources available, and the support from the provider community to help lift that up and help fill those gaps in a sustainable way. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next on my list, I do not have the name. What I have is a foster parent from Nexus Kindred Family Focus. Nope. Okay, we'll go on to the next one. Sorry. Next. Okay, next I have James O'Donnell, Director of West Central Juvenile Detention Center. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself and then begin your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is James O'Donnell. I'm representing, I'm the superintendent at the West Central Regional Juvenile Center. I know it's been referred to as a couple different times this meeting, but I'm representing the MNJDA, which is Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association. And all the juvenile centers in the state are facing the same types of problems. We're having the same types of pressures placed on us. So my testimony, I want to highlight the significant gaps in children's mental health in Minnesota. I want to begin my testimony with a story of increased reliance on juvenile detention centers when it comes to responding to children's mental health. For anatomy purposes, I changed the name, and or it's just a generic area. The name I chose, I always choose it, is my daughter's name, which is Madison. So here we go. Madison, this is a very true story, too. Madison, a 14-year-old autistic girl, is detained after she was attempting to commit suicide by getting run over on a busy highway. Detention was not law enforcement's first choice by any means. The first choice was Madison's mother. However, Madison's mother refused to take custody of her and wanted her daughter placed somewhere that could keep her safe. Madison has a long history with social services and had many numerous community services and even some out-of-home placements. Law enforcement reached out to social services where they too were unable to help as no places would accept Madison due to her aggressive behaviors and history of noncompliance. Law enforcement in conjunction with social services had no choice but to charge Madison with the lowest charge possible to get her into juvenile detention. Madison was eventually placed in the non-secure program at the detention facility. In addition to ASD, Madison also had uncontrolled epilepsy. In order to better understand her epileptic needs, a neurology appointment was set up. While at that neurology appointment at a local hospital, she began to behave erratically and physically. Hospital staff had to restrain Madison and for her safety, and the doctor placed a freeze on Madison as she was clearly in need of psychiatric care. The facility supervisor then called the local adolescent psychiatric hospital to begin the referral process. The referral process was going as planned until the hospital found out that a juvenile detention center was making the referral. Upon learning that the referral was coming from a juvenile detention center, the hospital intake worker informed the supervisor that they had no beds available. The supervisor indicated that she is on their daily announcement email list, and this morning the hospital sent out an email stating that they had four open inpatient adolescent beds. The intake worker suggested that the open beds were for youth 10 and younger, and the hospital worker apologized that there was nothing they could do. The facility supervisor then spoke to the neuro doctor who placed the hold on Madison. She asked the doctor if the doctor could push their weight to get the psych hospital to accept Madison. After a couple hours passed, staff were informed that the psych hospital would conduct a needs assessment and could bring Madison to the psych hospital. Mm-hmm. Juvenile detention staff then transported Madison to the psych hospital. A needs assessment was conducted and concluded that Madison was not in need of inpatient care and the youth should return back to the juvenile detention center. The facility supervisor was notified of this and directed her staff to get whatever services they could get for Madison from anywhere. The psych hospital offered their day programming, where Madison would get services in an outpatient-type basis. The staff took the referral information back with Madison to the juvenile detention center. After all the approvals and referrals were granted, the juvenile facility transported Madison to the day programming. Staff returned to the juvenile center and soon got a phone call saying they needed to come pick Madison up. Staff could hear yelling in the background and asked what was going on. Staff said it sounded like she's having a mental health crisis and she's in the right place. The psych hospital's intake worker then called the juvenile detention supervisor. The supervisor said that she believes that Madison's in a mental health crisis and would only accept her back if she got a letter signed by an MD, which is a medical doctor, saying that the juvenile center is an appropriate placement for her. Shortly after the conversation, the juvenile center supervisor received a call from the psych hospital's intake director. The intake director notified the supervisor that local police were getting impatient and were not going to charge Madison with anything, but would help transport Madison back to the juvenile detention facility. The supervisor asked the obvious question. And here's where I need to point, why is PD there? And then this is where I just got to pause and kind of let it all reminisce and sink in. An inpatient psychiatric hospital called local law enforcement to de-escalate a 14-year-old autistic girl that's in their hospital at the moment. The supervisor said that she did not need police and would come get Madison as soon as she got the letter signed by an MD. The hospital did send that letter and requested that the juveniles... The hospital did send the letter as requested, and the juvenile supervisor and a couple staff went to pick Madison up. The supervisor had some of a rapport with Madison and was able to calm her down and get her to comply with being safe in that moment. Madison then spent the next month, a little over a month, at the juvenile center receiving care and working on home integration. Madison was able to return home to her mother's care. Overall, there are many similar stories similar to this that take place all across the state of Minnesota, all juvenile centers, and it's happening on a weekly basis. The reality of the situation is that youth with significant mental health needs are in correctional placement. This is true last year, this is true this year, and it'll be true next year. And it's only exponentially getting worse. There's very little to no federal money or state money that's being used to support juvenile centers. In addition, when a youth is placed in secure detention, their medical assistance is stopped. So that means the county's got to pick it up. So, which isn't that big of a deal, but the continuity of care isn't there anymore. When you start services and stop services and start services, it's more expensive and it's less effective. And then in addition, there are several pieces of legislation that was passed last legislative session. Many of these were supported by the MNJDA, and we're happy to see Minnesota moving in a positive, progressive direction. However, there was no funding attached, leaving counties to cover the increased cost for services of needing to provide one-to-one care for some kids at some certain times. So three solutions I kind of offer, research the Social Security Act around the Inmate Exclusion Clause. We understand that there are some states that have gotten around this with predisposition residents and pre-adjudicated adults, same thing. People that are, it's kind of a due process question. You know, should you take an entitlement away from somebody when they haven't ever been convicted of anything yet? The second one would be provide some state funding to juvenile facilities to address the ever-increasing mental health cases in our care. MNJDA does not believe that juvenile centers should take the replace of mental health programs. In fact, we believe Minnesota can and should do better. However, the reality of the situation is that youth are with us today and will be until Minnesota can get a continuum of care that effectively deals with children's mental health. Juvenile centers are truly caring for the youth with the most significant needs and are doing so with limited county funds. The third part is the part that I believe is backing up a lot of things, and it's review 245D licensing. Work with actual practitioners and providers to fix these issues so they'll be able to once again provide community-based programs and options for aggressive youth. Because right now, these aggressive youth are being placed with us and receiving their services with us. With that, thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome, and thank you for taking the time to meet with us and to provide us with your information. Next on the list, I have Joel Bakken, licensed psychologist and executive director of Solutions Behavioral Healthcare Professionals. If you'd like to come forward, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then begin your testimony.
Sorry.
That's all right.
It's James's fault, okay. My name is Joel Bakken, and I'm the Executive Director of Solutions Behavioral Healthcare Professionals. It's a nonprofit mental health facility. We have offices from St. Cloud to Moorhead here in all the major cities. We do many of the services that were previously mentioned by Illumina's CEO. So we have a full range of services. I want to talk about a couple of the services. Yes, we do early childhood mental health. We also are involved with school-linked mental health services, but more recently we're involved in what's called the Mobile Transitions Grant. That's a grant that the state has given or allowed us to participate in, where we as an agency facilitate the transition from hospital settings to back home for kids that are currently in these facilities. Girard was mentioned earlier. That would be an example of that. There's Hoffman. All of these facilities currently are down in St. Cloud is the closest one. I think Sauk Center. And otherwise, they're in Minneapolis. So it's quite a distance. But I want to spend a few minutes talking for you to imagine what we're going through as a provider right now and speak to some of the issues that we're facing under Chapter 245D, which is a statute that was made back in 2015 in response to the Jensen settlement. And it was about the overuse of restraints and behavioral procedures and what it has resulted in with agencies like ours. So we recently get referrals. I should mention that we have one of my colleagues in the back of the room mentioned that he had 5 referrals last Friday for them to provide corporate foster care. And every one of them had a behavioral issue. And every one of them was rejected. This is typical for us as an agency as well. We are in no position now to serve those kids with aggressive behaviors. And if you give me a few minutes, I'll talk to you about why. And it's somewhat of the response and what has happened with 245D. That regulation focuses mostly on person-centered practices, which I highly agree with adults. It makes sense. We want people to be empowered. We want folks to understand that they have a say in their life. What has happened with that has transitioned into children. So we are now left with not being able to do many things with kids that would be considered normal parenting. For example, I'll give you a few. You can't have a structured bedtime unless the kid is engaged in that process. So he will do the setup of that bedtime routine. You cannot have them brush their teeth before they use the video game. You cannot even use Granny's rule, which is eat your vegetables before you get your dessert. These are all considered prohibited procedures under 245D. I'm not saying 245D didn't come about for a good reason. I'm suggesting that it's just sent the pendulum far too far to the right. So we as service providers for corporate foster care don't even consider now someone with an aggressive behavior. So what James was talking about recently, where he said, oh, we don't have anywhere to send these folks, there is no step-down option for these kids. Doesn't make sense. We need that. So I have some ideas, and I want this committee to think about this, at least some of my recommendations here. I apologize, my mouth is getting dry right now, so bear with me. But a couple of the recommendations are that obviously I'm looking at revising 245D to add a children's section that would consider the values of mom and dad and have that as the overriding principle in what we're trying to do with this child. Focus on reunification. I think the core of this is to get kids back with their families. That's really critical for me as well, as a service provider. Clarify the definition of punishment. That is loosely defined, and regulators and licensures have liberal use of that term right now, so it can include things that would be normal parenting. We, as Solutions, pride ourselves in using evidence-based procedures. Those are excluded right now under 245D. As a corporate care, foster care facility, you cannot use evidence-based interventions. Another revision I would like under 245D is to have some internal consistency in the regulation. Positive support rule is not consistent with, which they mentioned many times under 245, is not consistent with the prohibited procedures. And lastly, I want to have this committee support the licensures of board certified behavior analysis. The language for licensing board certified behavior analysts has been vetted and is supported by the Board of Psychology, the Minnesota American Psychological Association, the Autism Treatment Association of Minnesota, and many other agencies. This licensure would protect the public from harmful and inappropriate behavioral treatments, which would further support Minnesota's leadership in providing quality human services and the intent of Rule 245D. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your suggestions. Next on the agenda, I have Ms. Kate Coughlin. Next is Family Healing.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Kate.
I checked the microphone. Is it got the green light? Okay. No, there you go.
Good?
Yep, good.
Hello, I'm Kate Coughlin. I am the Executive Director of Nexus Path Family Healing and recently a transplant and concerned citizen of the city of Moorhead, Minnesota. Former provider with an agency on the Minnesota side prior to going over to Nexus Path Family Healing. To heal a child, you must heal the system. It's really a simple concept. To add to this, children and their families don't heal in places that they're not from. They like to heal in places that they know. They live in homes and communities. They don't live alone. They exist in complex systems that have lasting impacts on their emotional and physical well-being. And it's our responsibility as a community of providers and a community of governing individuals to build an infrastructure that supports our children and families across accessing mental health services in their homes and in their communities, regardless of location throughout the state of Minnesota. I've seen the impact that intensive in-home services can make firsthand. While working in Minnesota, I was fortunate enough to be involved with the implementation of the Collaborative Intensive Bridging Services, or CIBS, model in the northwest part of Minnesota. Youth referred to this program were often on the final step before yet another residential treatment placement, often, you know, maybe a fourth, fifth, or sixth time in their young lives. The service provision is based on a high level of therapist interaction with the family and with the individual child. The therapist spends hours per week working with the child and the family through therapeutic services, providing phone or virtual support as needed, and working to ensure that the family system remains at the center of the treatment model. Sometimes, as administrators, we implement modalities that we think might work, but we don't fully grasp just how much of an impact they can have. In my case, it was SIBS. I kept hearing stories of children not needing to go into higher levels of care, children being able to manage it in their homes and in their schools, stories of kids getting a chance to be kids and have their mental health symptoms managed more effectively in their home communities. A model like SIBS can't be done anywhere but in the community. The level of care requires integration and opportunities for therapists to work alongside families, to work alongside kids, and to work alongside other service providers like schools and county case management. There's a particular circumstance that I recalled where I was asked to cover a case in our intensive in-home services program, so much like SIBS. I worked with parents whose children had been placed into foster care, and this family had a lot of children. And during this process, I was able to develop a therapeutic enough relationship with this family who were resistant to the process. I was able to develop that relationship with not just the parents, but with the children. It was humbling to watch the transformation of this particular family through the process of engaged in-person work. This family was able to find hope and healing through this high service model, and after much work, the family reunited and continued with in-home services after reunification. SIBS isn't the only model in the continuum of intensive in-home services. The list of services that are evidence-based, intensive, and done in-home is lengthy. And as providers, we all want to serve kids in the best way that we can. However, a lack of funding to support the arduous process of training and implementation deters many an agency from pursuing these models. While we operate in a nonprofit space, we must be able to create a reimbursement pathway that supports providers being able to prioritize these services. The majority of intensive in-home high-intensity service models require that providers have minimally their graduate degree and intermediate licensure, meaning that they've completed graduate school and have a clinical trainee status. There's some modalities that require advanced licensure to be a practicing clinician. With current funding pathways limited, it's a challenge for the providers who have a strong mission tie to these types of services to pursue them due to the competition in the marketplace for fully credentialed therapists and mental health professionals. When agencies are concerned about reimbursement rates from public sources such as Medicaid and Title IV-E, it becomes taxing to work to develop these programs and services that are primarily reimbursed through those payers. When those are the primary funding sources, there is also not a pathway for development. So agencies are not positioned to expand services, especially if they are operating in a nonprofit sector. Another area of need, in need of our attention as a state holds a special place for me. It's the idea behind foster care, treatment foster care, kinship care, and relative placement. State by state, we have discussions on the incredibly high need for this level of service and the absolute shortfall of providers. Treatment foster care, also called therapeutic foster care, is out-of-home care by foster parents with specialized training to care for a wide variety of children and adolescents, usually those with significant emotional, behavioral, or social issues or medical needs. Treatment foster care is designed to provide safe and nurturing care to a child in a more structured home environment than a typical foster care placement, and it can be a cost-effective alternative to residential placement. Foster parents typically receive additional supports and services and training. Treatment foster care is a less restrictive option for youth, and an increase in providers can allow for a decrease in the strain currently felt on PRTFs and QRTPs statewide. In order to increase the number of providers we have that are prepared and confident to take on the care of a child with complex mental health needs, we must invest in a funding mechanism that allows individuals and families throughout Minnesota to choose foster care as a profession and a vocation. Caregivers and TFC truly are an extension of the mental health care system and must be compensated in a manner that does not force them to choose between caring for a child and maintaining full-time employment. The youth in their care require full-time parenting. We cannot continue to support these youth in the least restrictive environment of TFC when families are being forced to choose between fostering and saving for retirement. Providers in TFC receive high levels of training and support from agencies. They are expected to mitigate risk in the community with youth who often have significant needs. It is our responsibility to treat our TFC providers as the professionals that they are, inclusive of contributions to health plans, such or access to Medicaid like the children they are supporting, access to contributions to Social Security and other chosen retirement plans, and access to agency-level professional supports, such as mental health therapists, case managers, social workers, and other professionals through in-home services that support the youth in their care. Minnesota, much like nearly all states, is in a period of crisis where youth are being boarded in locations, as we've previously heard about, that are doing the best that they can. But these are not places where children should be housed. We cannot continue to board kids in hospitals and emergency departments and detention centers or hotels. We must work together to develop a system of care that allows for an expansion of less restrictive options like QRTPs, PRTFs, or treatment foster care homes. These are places where children can heal and grow, and most importantly, where they can be children. These are places where permanency can and will be the goal, where it's not about quick stabilization, rather about the beginning of a healing journey that can carry them into adulthood. So I implore you as a governing body to consider these thoughts for the betterment of children and families throughout Minnesota. While system change is never an easy process, by prioritizing and fixing our mental health rates, developing infrastructure dollars in order to secure earlier intervention services, bundling payment rates to ensure agency sustainability, and professionalizing foster care as the vocation it truly is, Minnesota can etch its place among trailblazing state partners in the quest for equitable access to mental health care services statewide. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for taking the time to come before us today. Next, I have Dana Jystad from Sanford. Welcome. Yes, and you can come up too. And Shelby Fry, who's also from Sanford. Welcome. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourselves and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much. Yes, my name is Dana Jystad. I am a licensed social worker at Sanford ER. I'm duly licensed in social work in both North Dakota and Minnesota. I am very thankful for to chair as well as the committee for hosting this event. I'm also thankful for my leadership notifying me of this event late last week. Really wanting to be a part of the conversation, knowing what we're seeing at the Sanford ER, and doing what we can in terms of what we are seeing in child mental health in the ER. I work very closely with my providers as well as with psychiatry, doing what I can to assist with families, with wider networks, with Clay County as well as multiple Minnesota counties, including Beltrami, Polk. I just worked with a county worker from Mower County that's way in Austin, Minnesota last week. I've been seeing in my almost four years as a Sanford employee an increase in children staying in our ER for a length of time. I'm seeing barriers in terms of initiating immediate community support for families and interventions for their children in the home to, again, be another a network to assist in connecting the dots and getting the right people involved. Knowing from an ER standpoint that acute need that I've heard so much of this testimony today about families, from caseworkers, from other providers, speaking to the barriers that we're seeing in the state. And knowing, I think that's safe to say, of being Sanford, just across the river, treating these Minnesota residents the best we can, and working with this other set of services. So I recognize the lengthy list I call every day, if not every other day, for inpatient psych treatment. There's approximately 14 psych facilities that can treat pediatric patients for acute psychiatric treatment with all aggression caps. Meaning if there's any sort of history, even if that's 6 years ago, if there's any history of aggression, it's almost an immediate no. And people hanging up the phone on me before I can even explain the situation of what's going on. I have been working with multiple children, unfortunately, again in an ER setting, that I've come to know, that I have seen multiple times on multiple occasions trying to assist where we can. I have worked with a particular youth, she's about 14 years old, who stayed in our ER for 3 weeks because there was no alternative. She was under the custodian of the county, who was exhausting all her options, knowing, yes, she's 14, but she had been care since she was a six-year-old for extreme child abuse and neglect from her biological parents. I've seen where we tried our best in terms of making that intervention to assist her in her care, but also recognizing that holding a child in our ER is also not therapeutic, that is a strain on our resources for our staff and doing what we can to meet that child's individual needs, but also recognizing that in an ER room, the walls start to close in quickly and there's only so much intervention that we can do to truly meet that child where they're at while we wait for additional services. On a personal note, I also have an older sister who has adopted 3 children. She has 2 biological and 3 adopted children who have also been through the system and trying to access additional resources. That I can see a loving, caring family who has this wraparound support, financial assistance, where there's limited financial barriers for services with still a closed door in terms of getting services started within the school, early intervention, because of the need is so great that we are waiting and waiting and waiting because of the multiple referrals and waiting for it to be your turn, as other needs always arise. I just want to say thank you, because I'm really appreciative to be able to be here and say from a short snippet of what I see in the ER. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. And then go ahead, Shelby Fry, introduce yourself and who you're with, and then begin your testimony, please.
Okay. Thank you. Shelby Fry, I'm psychiatric nurse practitioner in the ER at Sanford. Dana is my right hand and convinced me to come in here today. Thanks, Dana. But I do appreciate what you all are doing, because it's pretty awful, the conditions. And, you know, I started at Sanford in 2019. I came from Montana. We have not so great resources in Montana. Many more here, but I'd describe them as discombobulated. There's no continuity. There's no any sort of coordination of care. It's a different, interesting level of management that I had no idea, and it doesn't really help. So since I've been here in 2019, I used to see about one or two kids a week in the ER, and that has changed to one to three a day in the last 3 years. The numbers are staggering. I don't even see adults anymore, and it's really outrageous. And kids, in by no means, are a simple case ever. There's a lot involved, and the amount of time they have to spend in the cement box in the ER is heartbreaking. I know most of the children that have been mentioned here today. I've seen them, and I wish I could have done more. And that's the helplessness that we feel in the ER too, is we get these kids that come in and you know, this is the end of the line, and nobody knows what to do with them anymore, and neither do I, because none of these hospitals will take them. Oftentimes they don't meet inpatient criteria for a psychiatric hospital because it's not an imminent risk. It's not something that we're sure is going to happen right at this moment. So that's the criteria that the hospitals use to say, no, you need a long-term treatment facility. And I agree, we do, but we don't have that either. And it's not something we can do from the ER, and it's months and months of waiting. And I see these kids a half a dozen times before they get any sort of resources, months and months later. And what they have to go through in the meantime, missing school and in and out of facilities, and the parents, their relationships. I mean, it's so much. It really is awful, and it's helpless feeling. We had a similar situation last week. I mean, we probably, you guesstimated one every 4 to 6 weeks that spends over a week with us, or at least 80 hours probably. Come in on the weekend, and we can't find anywhere for them till Wednesday or Thursday. And more often than not, those kids, we end up trying to come up with a safety plan to go home and just do the same thing that they've been doing over and over again. How many times can you do that before the child takes it into their own hands and does something significant that we all knew was coming, but we just don't have a place for them to go and get better in the meantime. I'd say of all those kids that I see in the ER in Fargo, half of them are from Moorhead. Many of them come from 50-plus miles away in Pahrump and Park Rapids and Breckenridge and all these places. And then we've got another complicating factor of trying to get these kids who are now in a North Dakota facility back to their state. And we get pushback from that, too, because, well, they're in a North Dakota facility. We can't take them. We've got other Minnesota people. Well, then why did they bring them to the ER in Fargo? You know, there's so many variables. It's terribly sad. I rack my brain every day. I go home and I think about this, and I sleep, you know, terribly thinking about it. And it just doesn't seem right or reasonable. Sometimes I discharge kids back to where they came from because it's better. It's less of a risk of harm to them than it would be to spend 3 or 4 days in the cement block of the emergency department. So then you have to think of, well, what's the, you know, clinical utility of this child being here? I can keep them safe, yes, but how does that destroy their emotional state and feeling supported and trust and all those things that we need that they don't have? And now it's worse because they're abandoned. And literally sometimes are. And that was my kid this last week, is 4 visits to the ER in a month. Dad's not answering the phone anymore. Kid's insurance in Minnesota expired because he went to Dad's house. Dad's insurance at Dad's house in North Dakota never got started, never got initiated. Mom's not answering the phone in Minneapolis. Kid's been abandoned. And nowhere will take him. In the meantime, he's banging his head on the walls because he's so frustrated and he can't communicate. And he's mad at his parents, but he doesn't want to go with them. He wants a foster home, but his parents are legal guardians, so that's not a thing. You know, there's just, he's been kicked out of every group home in the state of Minnesota. Well, because he's behavioral, he runs away. Yes, because that's how he's learned how to communicate to get his needs met. You know, we've done a lot of this to these kids. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to come and share with us. And next I have Kirsten Anderson. Hello, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then you can start your testimony. And I think you'll need to turn on the mic there. It looks like it's got the red light on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Turn on the mic. There you go.
Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson, and I'm the executive director of Aspire Minnesota, a statewide association of child and family serving providers. Today, I'm also here as co-chair of the Children's Committee of the Mental Health Legislative Network. We advocate for solutions that can swiftly and effectively build the services children and families need. We're grateful to be in Moorhead today and hear from local experts about how there is excellence in care that's making a transformative difference for children and families. That there are clear gaps in access to care that are prompting unnecessary crisis, heartache, and costs, and that there are solutions that are within reach to build the children's mental health continuum that is desperately needed. First, for some context, I just want to share what was distributed in your packets. First, you have a loss of capacity memo. This outlines that in the very broad category of children's residential facilities, Minnesota lost 888 beds, or 36% total capacity in the last two decades. Though this is a really broad category, the statistic is instructive, especially in the light of the increasing global trend of acute mental health needs for children. There are a myriad of reasons for the shrinkage of children's residential services. And the total loss of beds absolutely relates to the crisis in boarding for children and fundamentally points to the need to build the children's mental health system of the future. This memo is to set context, not to invite us to step back and recreate history. We want a family-centered, increasingly community-based system with robust early intervention, intensive in-home models to equip families to care for children while at home, and a full continuum that can deliver the right care at the right time, including high acuity short-term care and longer care residential supports when needed. We want individualized care to support each child and family within the right care at the right time in the right setting. Then the roadmap illustrates currently available services. Positively, we have much of what is needed in our existing service array, most included in our state Medicaid plan. As we heard again today, we are failing too many children and families due to a lack of access. Failing our kids is painful at many levels, impacting our families, schools, communities, safety net, healthcare, and public safety systems. Inadequate investments and service designs are incredibly costly, all in the wrong direction. Positively, we have some building blocks before you to speak to the solutions that you as legislators can pursue to address this crisis and build the system of the future. Increasing access to mental health services by increasing rates is the most important building block. Medicaid is Minnesota's primary payer for children's mental health care. Medicaid payment rates thus are foundational for care, including staff salaries, the ability to recruit and retain professionals who make all of the difference in delivering quality care, training, supervision, consultation, coordination for complex children and families. These are the critical elements that all have been suffering under today's rate structure that is averaging about 40% less than the cost to deliver care. Said more positively, fixing our rates will have the greatest impact in helping to transform our mental health system to deliver the right care at the right time in the right setting. No other policy or investment can make a greater difference. It is critically important that we address our Medicaid outpatient mental health rates in the 2024 session. Additional building blocks include expanded family-centered in-home children's mental health services. As you've heard today, we have a number of excellent intensive models to support families. Many of these models are in our state Medicaid plan, available for implementation. The problem is that these models barely exist due to staffing challenges and the rigor required to build these models. One-time investments in infrastructure to hire, train, and establish more of these models throughout the state, in addition to addressing the rates, can make a timely and significant impact. Orange. Building effective service models, building respite models for families to have a break as they care for complex children, increasing capacity in children's residential crisis stabilization, and growing community-based group care can make a tremendous impact to decrease the number of children boarding, individualize care to meet complex needs, and sustain care within family homes when possible. Preserve children's mental health residential treatment and build back to the licensed capacity in our children's residential treatment facilities, including psychiatric residential treatment facilities or PRTFs, so we can serve more children by supporting onboarding with staff training and professionalization. I think this is really important that we currently have pretty significant capacity in our children's residential mental health treatment that we have not yet brought back post staffing challenges in the pandemic. And we need to do so we can treat many of the children that you've heard about today instead of feeling as though we need to break new ground across the state. And none of this is, you know, all of these things require all of the things. Finally, replicate positive support services to understand how to support each individual child and meet their needs in ways that can prevent dysregulated behavior that can be disruptive and dangerous for the child and others. This disability support model could bring great value to many of our children's mental health services. These building blocks, though playful and simple in nature, point to the most important message of this hearing, that you, as leaders, can make the decisions to build the children's mental health system we need. We do not need more studying, planning, or delays. We can proceed swiftly with the solutions that we know can work that will make the greatest difference for our children and families in the least amount of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to offer any testimony at this point in time? Not seeing anyone stand up or indicating they're coming forward. I'd like to open it up to the members at the table here for any questions. As I'm taking a look, does anyone have any questions or comments that they would like to make at this time or any questions of our testifiers?
Chair Fisher, I'd just like to thank the, especially the emergency room people that were talking about this system that we have where the children are caught in this, I can't think of any other term than purgatory as they're trying to find placement for them, knowing that the only other backup is secured lockup in a jail-like facility, which is even, you know, a worse kind of purgatory, if you ask me. We have, and during my career, I was caught up in situations like this where we have this constant not it mentality. Mm-hmm. And it always falls back either on emergency rooms or that secure facility. How do we make changes in the statute? And I don't know which one of the experts would be the one to tell us how do we fix this. How do we get that psychiatric care for these kids and get them out of the emergency room and get them out of secured detention? And I realize it's a very big issue, but how do we do that? What changes do we need to make so that we have a situation as they were describing before where you've got a child that's obviously in a psychiatric crisis, but the psychiatric crisis facility won't take them? So that's my question. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Other comments, or is there anyone that would like to try to answer his question more than we've already heard? Yes, if you'd like to come forward, please identify yourself Thank you for being here today.
If it's green, it's on.
Yep, it's on.
I'm Nicole Flick. I own ABC123 Child Enrichment Center here in Dilworth. I can answer that question. You fund 0 to 3. Her daughter, it was 2 years old when she found that out. Her daughter, she was 3 years old. Nobody gave them services for 0 to 3. I own a child care center. 20 children in a room full of four-year-olds. 16 of them have an IEP. 2 teachers who are being paid $15 an hour. No services. You fund 0 to 3, 0 to 5, as you do the rest of the schools, and you get us the mental health supports we need, and that's how you fix your problem. They won't end up in prison. They won't end up in hospitals. You will fix them when they're little, and they will thrive as adults. That's all I want to say. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Other comments from committee members as I take a look. Representative Keeler.
So I thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question because I feel like we always say like youth, right? But I know working in the homelessness world, some of our youth stuff goes up to age 24. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page that you're talking when an individual reaches the 18th birthday, they no longer have any support for this. Like I get worried about 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds when their frontal lobes still aren't even fully developed. We know that. But can somebody just verify that it is that when we talk in the mental health world and all of this, we stop services at the age of 18, whole hard stop.
I see a hand in back there. If you see several hands, if you folks would like to come forward. And the green light is on the microphone. So go ahead and re-identify yourself, please.
Kate Coughlin, Nexus Family Healing, 21. Yep, so there's extended foster care services. They can access CTSS services until the age of 21 if they're enrolled in school. So, and then if they're a 245D, like a CADI or DD waiver, those children can stay in school until 22. So they can stay connected to their home district.
Hit the microphone there. Thank you.
So with a lot of our programming, when youth are receiving services through our CADI waiver or just in general child welfare services, we do try to transition those kids into adult services, getting them the necessary continued CADI services. Youth who are aging out of foster care have the ability to stay in extended foster care. So those youth who might be turning 18 during their senior year, we work with them on a plan to either stay in the current foster home they're in or to move to their own independent living site. We have kids who we develop plans where they have certain requirements to work so many hours per month or be attending a post-secondary or high school, where we work with them on a plan to transition out. And then once they reach that 21 age, we refer them to stay in the community, which is another service that helps those youth to remain housed and homed and receive services.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Keeler. Oh, yes, please come forward again. And this is
Shelby Fry.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So in the world of psychiatry, youth stops at 18 after you've graduated from high school. So if you're 18 but still in high school, you can be treated on a adolescent psychiatric unit, most of them, subjective. But 18 and completed with high school is an adult.
Okay, thank you. All right, we've got about 7 minutes left. So, but once again, I'll ask: is there anyone out front here that has anything they'd like to add? Seeing not, one more time. Oh, yes, please. If you'd like to introduce yourself, and I remember you're with the counties.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angie Teese, and I serve as the Child Wellbeing Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties and have the distinct pleasure of working with our human service directors and our public health directors across the state. I am a resident of White Bear Township and Representative Curran's district, and I'm delighted. What I would like to add is that many of the voices you heard today have had some type of connection with the county. And the county serves counties across the state of Minnesota serve a unique role in both being a conduit for state-funded programming through grants or through direct funding opportunities, potentially philanthropic or otherwise. And in addition, in the two families instances, the county has served as the entity that's coordinated services and helped link them or network them to existing services and helped identify where there are gaps and advocate on their behalf. The county role is extremely unique in wanting to service and support our families, both proactively and then in the cases where we can't from a child protection standpoint. And so we are uniquely positioned to talk about the nuances and the complexities. And then what I would also like to say is that in many cases where state funding through grants or other entities fall short, the county and I think Clay County has been very fortunate, and they've been able to step in and help bridge some of that funding with the board support. With that being said, when that happens, that is on the backs of property taxpayers and is usually a result of increase of county levy dollars. And so as we think about what the future looks like and how to really get ahead of this and build a continuum, I would ask committee members and the leadership of our great state to really think about the roles that each entity plays, both from a provider standpoint, from a community standpoint, from a state standpoint, and from the county standpoint, to ensure that anything that we do is sustainable and that we are leveraging federal resources and state resources to the extent possible, and that as we build a service array, that it shouldn't matter what your zip code is or what your county line is, but you should be able to access those same services and supports, like SIBS, like CTSS, et cetera. And all of that requires access to a workforce that is supported, a county workforce that is supported with technology, with pay, with mental health, all of it, and a provider base that is supported as well and has access to pay rates, and that we as a state are prioritizing a mental health workforce, and we are attractive, and we are attracting a mental health workforce and leveraging our great university systems that exist within the state to help bridge that pipeline and address the workforce shortages. I'll pause here because I can talk about it from a state perspective. Rhonda Porter is your Clay County Social Services Director, and she can fill in any gaps for me.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Well, welcome, Rhonda. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members, for traveling to Moorhead today and allowing us to share our stories and provide testimony. As Angie indicated, much of our work in social services, county human service work, is governed by statute and Minnesota rules. As a state-directed, county-administered system, that we partner with the state of Minnesota, and we partner with a variety of our community members, many of which you heard from today, to deliver a lot of the mandated services that we provide. The Comprehensive Children's Mental Health Act requires the Commissioner of Human Services to create and ensure a unified, accountable, comprehensive children's mental health system. In that, we have that role, that state-directed, county-administered system. We have a role in that work. We do at Social Services, County Human Services, we provide an array of services anywhere from the point of that phone call from that family who's saying, I'm struggling. It might be with a 3-year-old child. It might be with a 17-year-old child in terms of children's mental health services. And our responsibility is to assure that proper assessments are done so that we can determine the best level of services, make referrals, provide case management services, provide many of the required and mandated services from our state, and assure that we can best meet those needs along with our community partners. We provide some of these services ourselves at the county level, and in many cases, we contract out with our community partners. There are a number of grants and allocations that the county receives through the Department of Human Services that aid in our development of mental health services, but unfortunately, they're underfunded, unpredictable based on various formulas or funding availability, and are not consistent across the state. We do have significant gaps in funding and an inadequate continuum of care, of which you heard about today. I shared some examples earlier about where the county does end up having to support some of the programs that we administer on behalf of the state, where the funding is inadequate. Areas such as respite care, where we, again, we're serving high acuity needs for kids, and so that funding does not go very far. We run out of funds, but we're not going to stop providing those services to keep those kids in the community and provide supports to their families. So we end up juggling the budget to try to meet that gap. Again, with various grants, because some are competitive in nature, we end up competing with our, you know, neighboring counties who have the same and similar needs as we do in terms of serving our kids. Having statewide funding for some of these, evidence-based services is critical, so that if you're lucky enough to live in Clay County and get one service, if you move, you could be lucky enough to get it there as well. I think that's really critically important in terms of that equity across the state, whether it's rural or metro or wherever you live. I'll end with that, and thank you so much for coming to Clay County and hearing our stories and our testimony.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming and testifying, and I want to say thank you to everyone who came to testify today and provide the information and share their stories. I know some of them are very tough for people to share, and I want to say thank you for putting yourselves out there and allowing us to hear your situations and help us understand better what we need to do more in the system. I know that as we're wrapping up here, some of the things that have come very clearly to my mind is it's a combination of things that we have to look at. It's not just dollars, but also some of the base policies that we have out there. I know over the last couple of years, we've been fortunate, we've been able to do a little bit better in this area, but we still have a very long way to go. What really helped is with some of the things I've heard is it's identified that we have, in some areas as we're building out the system, we have real large deserts in this state where the services don't come very well together. And I'm thinking of the PRTFs, you know. Those are an area that in some areas of the state it's getting it, in other parts we don't. And so we've got to do a better job in figuring out how do we break down the barriers between not only counties being consistent, but also between states. And I think one of the things I've learned a lot is that, well, you know, you've got North Dakota just across the river here, just a short distance, things don't flow well across the two because of the boundaries we have in the political units. So it's trying to figure out what can we do there. So I know I've received quite a bit of information that'll give us ideas of what to be working on in the coming session. I want to say thank you very much to the county here for hosting us. I know that we had several folks who were very instrumental in helping us put together the meeting here today. Jackie Fink, Rhonda Porter, Stephen Jarson. Think I got that right. I want to say thank you all for your help and support. We've been able to make sure that this is also streamed, so it's also been available to other folks in the state to be able to listen to this. And Representative Keeler, is there any final words you'd like to offer?
Just thank you. Thank you for making the drive. We do this drive often, right, to go to work half the year. And so it was really nice that as a chair you found it important enough to come out. And that other members across the state also made the trip to join to listen to what we have going on out here. So thank you. Right. And thank you all for continuing to show up. I feel like I keep hosting these meetings, and I'm sure they're going to get us somewhere. But that starts with, like, just sharing our story in more spaces and making sure that when these guys are at decision-making tables, they keep our community in mind. So thank you.
And we definitely will. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.